This podcast is brought to you by AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. Shares Magazine is published by AJ Bell Media, part of AJ Bell.
Hello, welcome back to the AJ Bell Money and Markets podcast. My name is Laura Suter and joining me this week is Dan Coatsworth.
Hi there, Laura.
So, what's coming up this week? We've got some details of a new mortgage for first-time buyers that only requires a £5,000 deposit. We've got an update on what's happening with WASPI women, as I'm sure you will all have seen the headlines on that. And we've got some news on how all our supermarket shopping habits have changed.
And we've also got a deep dive on Apple from our friends at Shares Magazine, as well as an interview with Ewan Marks and Brown from the Crux Asia ex-Japan Fund. Explains why he's excited about prospects for the electric vehicle sector. We'll also be talking about some updates from quite an interesting mix of names here. So Lululemon, Nike, NatWest, and Donald Trump's new media business.
So let's cover that market news first. The results from both Lululemon and I say Nike, but you say Nike. We will have to differ on that. But both of those companies were pretty disappointing. And maybe that means that the athleisure trend that has definitely gripped the nation over the past few years is coming to an end. I'm still trying to keep it going strong while working from home, but I obviously can't hold up the entire industry. So Dan, tell us more about both Lululemon and Nike.
Well, I've got to ask this question first. So Laura, when was the last time you spent more than £100 on some leggings?
Never in my life.
Yeah. I mean, Lululemon's got some quite interesting sort of sales trends over the years. You know, some people are sort of really happy to sort of splash this cash, but the company sort of flagged this slowdown in demand. And actually, it's not the only one. It seems to be a pretty tough market out there if you're trying to sell pricey sportswear or trainers, because consumers are still watching their spending. So Lululemon's sales in North America have slowed down a lot. Forward guidance for earnings is a little bit below expectations. And of course, what we got a problem here in the US is that lots of people had these stimulus checks during lockdown. Then they had lots of cash saved up and have been spending that down. And, you know, kind of that money all seems to have disappeared now. So they're shifting more to buying on credit, or some people just not buying stuff at all. So now, obviously, companies that sell pricey trainers and sportswear can't keep going on all cylinders in that sort of environment. So Lululemon, so it has been one of the market leaders for sort of women's athletic sort of kit, but it, you know, it's got really big competition as well, as obviously this fragile backdrop. So it's been trying to sort of push more on footwear, which is quite interesting, because if you look at Nike and even JD Sports, they're talking about this growing competition here. So Nike shares dipped at the end of last week, saying that it's seeing some pressures. China's not doing too well. So the company's been cutting costs, trying to be a bit more efficient. But I mean, analysts are sort of saying it kind of lost its focus a bit. It's fallen behind on innovation, losing out to sort of names like On Running and New Balance. But, you know, all that paints quite a gloomy picture. But JD Sports had literally just come out with a trading update as we're recording this podcast. And it's saying, yes, the trading environment's pretty challenging. Lots of promotional activity out there. But actually, its shares jumped because it gave a sort of quite positive outlook, saying it thinks things are going to get better. And the company's done incredibly well over the years in sort of hoovering up market share. And I guess, you know, with a business, you've got to take a bit of a longer term focus. And it certainly was coming out to be more upbeat. So I guess if you're in the market for some sportswear, now's probably quite a good time to get some bargains, because it's certainly flagging lots of promotions across the sector.
Handy to know for anyone who is going out shopping this weekend for any gym kit. Now, next item on markets news is NatWest. We already know that the government's planned to sell off part of its share in NatWest to individual investors, and we're expecting a timeline of that around the summer. But ahead of that, it's offloaded some of its stake to the professional investing market this week. So, Dan, how much did they sell off? And is that going to have any impact on the sale to the public later this year?
So it sold a little over 1% of the company. Now, the reason why this is quite interesting is that if you go back to the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, NatWest was one of several banks to be bailed out by the government. So the government there was essentially was left with an 84% stake in the company, what was then known as RBS Group. So the government stake in NatWest has now dropped below 30% for the first time since the bank was nationalized. Now, that means it's no longer a controlling shareholder, but it still implies it's got this big chunk of shares still to offload. And it's previously said it hoped to get rid of all this stock by 2025 or 2026 at latest. And it would only sell remaining shares when it represented value for money to do so. So actually the shares in the company have been doing quite well recently. And this is quite surprising because we know it wants to do a public share offer. So in order to sell stock to the public, and the report suggests it could be around June time, we'll see this offer, is that it would have to offer them at a price lower than the market. So it's interesting that it's almost like we've got this indication a company that owns 30% of a bank will have to sell them below market price. So why is the share price going up? That's quite an interesting thing here. So I wasn't expecting them to go up when you've got this sort of very clear overhang, but the sale that it did the other day of 1%, it's just, you know, in the bigger scheme of things, it's just a little fraction and stuff, and I'm sure it will just keep selling little chunks of them as and when it will find institutional buyers. But we'll just have to wait and see what price we'll get for the public offer. And of course, we'll come back to that on the podcast when we get all that information.
It's amazing how slow that process has been to kind of eat down that share that the government still owns. Such a slow process, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And now Trump has been dominating the headlines ahead of the US election, but actually this week he's hit them for a different reason. His media business has floated on the stock market. Firstly, Dan, I'm going to admit, I did not know he really had a media business or that it was planning to float on the stock market, that it was, you know, big enough and profitable enough to do so. So for other people in the same boat as me, what is this media business?
So he's got a business called Trump Media and Technology Group. And what it's done is it's kind of reversed into something called a SPAC, which is a special acquisition vehicle. I think even those sort of terminology is very confusing. Just think of it. We've got, there's a company that's already on the stock market called Digital World Acquisition Corp. And it's essentially just reversed into that to a quick way of getting a stock market listing. So Trump Media and Technology owns the Truth Social platform. It's essentially, if you think that Trump had a big spat with Elon Musk about, you know, being on Twitter and saying that the rules are too strict. So he launched his own social media platform. I had a quick look on its website and it calls it a uniting force for freedom of expression. So we won't go any further about it. But essentially what he's trying to sort of say, he wants to end big tech's assault on free speech by giving people the chance to say what they want. So that's the business. And yes, it's been sort of talked about that it was coming onto the stock market for a while. But it did have a pretty good start, I must admit.
Yeah. So how has it actually performed? What's the valuation of the company now? And how did the shares perform after it floated?
So it jumped onto the stock market, changed its name, changed the ticker. And at one point on that first day, it was up by more than 50%, 50.
Oh, wow.
And it ended up 16% on the session. So essentially that valued the whole business at nearly $12 billion. That made Trump's stake in it worth $4.6 billion. Big numbers and I think you made a really good point at the start, is that you didn't know what it was. And I think a lot of people don't know what it is. That valuation is quite remarkable, considering this business has never turned a profit. It earned, it's bonkers to say, $3 million in revenue. And it operates Truth Social, wants to launch a streaming service next year. I mean, this is like crazy. It barely scrapes a bean together to make any money. But I don't know why the market has valued it like this, but typically it's everyone went, okay, it's the return of meme stocks. It's the good old Wall Street Bets forum on the social media platform Reddit. Everyone was been talking about it, saying, you know, Trump's got fanatical supporters. Everyone's going to pile in. And what we saw was that trading in the shares was so volatile that it was actually suspended for a few minutes on a couple of days ago. And in the UK, we're hearing stories that it's really difficult to get a sort of a quote for the stock online. So I don't know whether this is just euphoria around the first day, but that, you know, the valuation doesn't match what the actual numbers that the business is producing. So it's certainly caught the market's attention. But you know, will it still be exciting to investors in month, 3-6 months time? I have to wait and see.
Yeah, and we will bring you updates. We've also had some interesting news this week about all our shopping habits. So through the cost of living crisis, we've had lots of people trading down to cheaper supermarkets, to those budget names. And that makes logical sense. If people have less money, then they're more likely to move to those cheaper offerings to cut their food costs, particularly when we saw such high food inflation. But actually, Dan, you've seen some research this week that maybe slightly dispels what we've been saying.
Yeah. So Kantar produce data on supermarkets on a regular basis. Their latest figures showed that Ocado and Waitrose were the only grocers to win new shoppers over the last 3 months. So if you think about who is the typical Ocado Waitrose shopper, I would argue that they're a wealthier individual. And what these companies have seen is a recent trend for faster growth in more expensive branded groceries versus supermarket own label products. And that is a total reverse of what we've been seeing over the last year or so. Now, supermarket own label products are still doing very well, but to be overtaken by branded stuff is, it does suggest a shift in the market here. So Ocado's improved its sales by 9.5% in the past 12 weeks. But actually, you know, Ocado's still only got a tiny market share in the UK, 1.8%. Waitrose has got 4.5%. I mean, those are tiny compared to Tesco, which is the market leader, and that's got just under 27%. So it's interesting to see those two names sort of stand out, because, you know, during the sort of cost of living crisis, it's all been about Aldi and Lidl's expansion, Sainsbury's offering cheaper stuff, Marks & Spencer's really pushing that value side of things, and Tesco, the value side of things. So yeah, very, very interesting different, you know, shift in those trends.
Yeah, definitely. And I wonder if maybe some of that is a shift of people not going out to eat so much, not going out and having those, you know, nicer experiences at home. So buying some nicer food from some of those brands rather than going out to eat, because we know that going out is quite expensive. Obviously, that will only be part of it, but you could see that being part of that trend, couldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And we had some data on grocery price inflation. That's eased to 4.5% over the 4 weeks to 17th March. So that's the lowest level since February 2022. So if you go back to March 23, gross inflation was at 17%. So if you think the rate of inflation for the cost of your sort of shopping is going down a lot, people are still watching their pennies, but I do get the sense that lots more people are sort of treating themselves at home just for the time being, I guess until we see a couple of interest rate cuts. But you know, prices are falling most rapidly on stuff like butter and milk, but they are going up on things like sweets and chocolate, interestingly, before Easter. Hot cross buns up 15% on last year. So you know, I guess, how many hot cross buns have you been buying, Laura, recently? Have you been firing that?
So many. Yeah. And now my tummy is rumbling at the thought of hot cross buns. Those food inflation figures are good news for overall inflation figures as well, aren't they? Because that drop in food inflation should then filter through into that headline rate of inflation. And hopefully we will see another meaningful drop at the next reading of inflation, which, as you said, then gets us a few steps closer to potential interest rate cuts.
Yeah, I mean, obviously interest rate cuts are so important. It's important to the stock market. It's important to people's finances, and there's a budgeting confidence with people. You know, do they feel confident trying to move to get a different job and stuff? So, we do talk a lot about interest rates, but you know, it feels like it could be a regular weekly feature on the podcast at the moment. But it is really important to do it, and you know, obviously they do feed into things like mortgage rates, and we've got a new product that aims to make it easier for first-time buyers to get on the property ladder. So, Laura, tell us more about what's going on.
Yeah, this is a very interesting product, I think, that's been launched. So it's from Yorkshire Building Society and came out this week. And their whole aim is to help first-time buyers get onto the property ladder. And they acknowledge that it's very hard for lots of first-time buyers to save a huge deposit that you need in some areas to get on the property ladder. So they've launched this new mortgage product where you only need a £5,000 deposit. Now you can borrow up to £500,000. And so actually, if you think about it, that represents a 1% deposit or a 99% mortgage. You don't have to borrow up to that £500,000 limit. Of course, you could... I think the lowest one that they're offering is 200,000. And so really what they're trying to do is remove that big hurdle that exists for some people, because we know between the high cost of renting and then cost of bills, even if you've got a decent job, without family support, you might find it very hard to save for a deposit. It's a 5-year fixed mortgage and the interest rate on it is 5.99%. So expensive in comparison to other 5-year fixes, and actually quite expensive in comparison to other 95% mortgages out there. So I think this is an interesting product. It's always really good to see innovation in the mortgage market as well, with often it's building societies launching these new and different products. But you have to think really carefully about whether this one might be right for you. Firstly, I think if you can save enough so that you can get a 5% deposit, then you'll have much more option in terms of 95% mortgages out there, and you can get a cheaper rate on those mortgages as well. So you need to think about, you know, the difference between the 5K that this product requires and how much extra you might need to save to get to that 5% deposit figure, and whether it's worth, you know, spending a bit of extra time to save that money so that you can get a cheaper product. The other thing that you need to consider in this is that you're still going to be subject to what we call income multiples when you're borrowing. So this is a mortgage lender will lend you a certain number of times your earnings each year, and then that's the maximum amount that you can borrow. And so usually this is about 4 or 4.5 times your salary. So if you were wanting to buy a home up to that maximum that this mortgage allows, so £500,000, then you would need to have a salary of around £120,000 a year. Now that could be, obviously that's a very high salary if you're on your own, but if you're buying with someone, that would be your combined salary. So you need to bear in mind that whilst this is saying you only need a 5% deposit and you can borrow up to £500,000, that's not going to be offered to everyone. You still need to have the salary to back that up, and you also will need to have good credit rating as well. When lenders are going out and lending these high loan to value multiples, they're very key on looking at people's credit rating, their ability to, you know, make regular payments in the past. And then the other thing I just wanted to flag is there is obviously a risk when you're borrowing a high amount, is there's a risk of falling into negative equity. So this is where if house prices drop, then you could end up owing more than your property is worth. And if you think, let's look at the higher end example of this, if you're buying a place worth £500,000 and you've only got £5,000 of equity in it, then that house price doesn't need to drop by very much before you're suddenly owing more than the property is worth. And so it's just something to really bear in mind where you're not putting much equity in, is that is a risk if house prices did fall. Now you would hope over the 5-year term of this mortgage, you, even if you saw a small drop in house prices at some point, you would hope that maybe they would rebound, but it is a risk. And there's also something to bear in mind for when that 5-year mortgage comes up. So it's a really good idea, if you can, to overpay on these mortgages so that you're building up more equity in the property, so that when you come to remortgage in 5 years, you've got more options of where you can remortgage to. So good innovation, interesting concept, but definitely not going to be right for everyone.
So another big news story of the past week is WASPI women, who are back in the news after an ombudsman called on the government to pay up to £10 billion in compensation for WASPI women. Now, our resident pensions expert, Tom Selby, is here to explain more. First up, Tom, the WASPI case hasn't really been in the news for a while, so I think it's probably best if you start off by telling us what's it all about.
Yes, it's been a long-running saga, Dan. So the state pension age in the UK is 66 for men and women today, but that hasn't always been the case. So there's two key pensions acts that have led to this controversy. So the Pensions Act 1995 and the Pensions Act 2011. So after World War II, the state pension age in the UK was 60 for women and 65 for men. But as a result of those two pensions acts, that's changed. So the first of those acts proposed equalising state pension ages for men and women at age 65 between 2010 and 2020. And then the second of those pensions acts, so 2011, accelerated that timetable, meaning that the state pension ages for men and women were actually equalised at 65 in 2018 before increasing to the current age of 66 by 2020. We're then going to see the state pension age on the current timetable increase to 67 by 2028 and 68 by 2046. So the WASPI campaign has focused on two fronts. So it's been on the fairness of those reforms, firstly, and secondly, whether or not the government did enough to tell the women who were affected by the changes that they were happening so that they could plan their retirement plans accordingly. So it's probably worth covering off the issue of fairness first. Now, that isn't what the Ombudsman rulings about. That's something that's been addressed separately in the courts. So in 2019, the High Court heard arguments that the state pension age increase discriminated on the grounds of age and or sex, and a sort of judicial review of the government's alleged failure to inform the women of those changes. Now, the court dismissed that claim on all three counts, and a Court of Appeal hearing in 2020 also failed. So the courts found that the changes were fair. What we've now had is an Ombudsman ruling, which has been going on for, I think, 5 years. So a really protracted piece of work looking at whether or not the government did enough to tell women that those changes were going to happen so they could plan. And so that's the ruling that we had last week. The Ombudsman, as you said, found that that the government didn't do enough, and as a result has recommended that the government pay a significant amount of compensation.
And so we think that the government is actually going to pay out this money? Have we had any indication from the government that they're going to comply with this Ombudsman ruling?
Yeah, this is the big controversial question. And you would think that if the government has an Ombudsman in place to make these kind of recommendations, then for that Ombudsman to be useful, it would follow through with those recommendations. However, the government, it seems like, is kind of playing for time on this. So it's a significant bill. We're talking about potentially £10 billion, as Dan said, at the top. The government, one of the key things here is the government doesn't have to abide by the Ombudsman's ruling. So the Ombudsman makes a recommendation and then the government decides whether or not it thinks that recommendation should be implemented. Now, clearly, the UK is in a pretty tight financial position. The Treasury's not got a huge amount of money to play with. And so given we're in a general election year, is what everyone's expecting. I think what we're probably seeing here is a political game being played with this, which isn't ideal. So the government is saying it's reviewing the report and will make a decision further down the line. Labour, for its part, which of course could form a government which would have to implement these recommendations or not, depending on what they decided. They've also said they're reading the report very carefully. So I think what you've got is two political parties who don't want to make a decision on this, because if you say you're going to abide by the ruling, then you're potentially going to have to find £10 billion down the back of a sofa. If you say you're not going to abide by the ruling, then those women affected will understandably be pretty unhappy with you and might punish you at the ballot box.
So if you're a WASPI woman, you're someone that's been affected by this, is there anything that you need to do now, or is it just a case of waiting to see what the government says?
Unfortunately, it is just a case of wait and see for those women affected at the moment. So it's a case of, will the current government or a future government decide to implement those recommendations? So the recommendation of compensation of between £1,000 and £3,000 per person. If it does decide to implement those recommendations, the next question would be, over what timetable would that happen, and would each person get the same amount, or would there perhaps be some sort of means testing applied to any compensation? But nothing to be done at the moment. It's just a case of seeing whether or not either political party will commit to abiding by the Ombudsman's decision.
Thanks a lot for that, and we will check back in as and when there are updates on that. Next up, we have our interview of the week, which is with Ewan Markson-Brown from Crux Asset Management. He was on the podcast a few weeks ago talking about Chinese retail group Temu, and he's now back to discuss the electric vehicle sector in Asia.
Where are we now in terms of sort of electric vehicle adoption in Asia versus perhaps in the West? Obviously, there's lots of headlines around a company like BYD selling more cars than Tesla. There's obviously lots of choice available in Asia for products, but is it going well, or actually are we seeing a sort of slight slowdown, which is what we're seeing in the West at the moment?
Let's take back to this. I think it was about 2018 where we were looking forward 5 years and reckoned that somewhere between 2022 and 2024, electric vehicles would be cheaper in absolute terms, not just full running cost, than ICE vehicles. And at that point, there's something what we call an S curve, which is a rapid adoption rate, you know, you're basically doubling. And at those points in time, you'll effectively get the majority, if not 70, 80% of all vehicles sold will be electric. We've hit that tipping point, and I can see it in battery prices. And really, the number we had in our mind 5 years ago was about $100 per kilowatt hour in terms of battery cost. We were last year, and these are rough numbers, call it 120 to 140 at the start of last year. CATL, which is the largest battery manufacturer in China and the world, I think they come out with a sub $60 battery cost by mid. We're going to be way cheaper on every single model in electric than ICE. So we're about to have a phase shift. Now, that phase shift is ongoing in China, and it's about to accelerate, and then it's going to go to the rest of the world. And we've been talking about this last 2 years, and we're really very excited by it, because it means not only do we move from ICE and to electric, and this is a 100-year platform change, but the very nature and quality of vehicles is changing. And I can talk about it in a second, but the design goes into a car, more software, more extra items. And that means consumers are going to start buying them.
In the West, the sort of the slight concern around prospective buyers is that, you know, yeah, we see that these vehicles are, you know, we see the benefits of it, but a bit concerned still about the charging infrastructure. You know, what if I break down? Also, increasingly, I'm hearing that if something goes wrong, can you actually find someone who understands the technology, who understands how to fix it? Or do you have to find a specialist? And of course, that's quite expensive, potentially.
Yeah. But both of these issues are issues of scale. That at small market size, early adoption rates, you have these issues, you know, that I can't find a supercharger, I've got to wait 10 minutes for my supercharger. These issues are being addressed in China, still there, but we're at that inflection point where they're building out the chargers. You know, there's an issue about batteries in cold weather, that starts to get resolved. I think what we're seeing in the Chinese markets for hybrid model, so have a battery plus an engine, an ICE engine, that's scaling up today, and then you move fully electric post that. And that's going to happen in the West. The real issue in the West is that Western OEMs have just fallen off the tech trajectory. They felt that they could price electric vehicles higher than ICE vehicles. And ICE vehicles, as you're probably aware, have been going up in price at least for a decade, maybe longer, due to regulations. And reverse is now happening. car costs are going to go down on a structural basis because they're becoming a tech product. So imagine your smartphone. And therefore, to maintain your average selling price, your ASP, you're going to have to add more technology and more features to your vehicle. So we're in China today, you're getting more software. So you're getting your ADAS level one, level two, so sort of parking, maybe it'll manage to drive you on the highway. Eventually, it can take you from A to B. But you're also getting things like karaoke machines. I've seen beds in cars. I've seen fridges in cars, boardrooms in cars. So you're seeing this rapid innovation, which is occurring in China. And the Western companies are kind of just looking on, going, well, what's going to happen? We know what's going to happen. The average build cost of a Chinese electric vehicle is about 50% of the price of a Western one. And I think we're all going to buy them.
So is there any sort of government initiatives from in the East at all? I mean, or I'm just wondering, or you know, there's no subsidizing of any sort of vehicles. It's simply that they're more affordable, they're widely available, and it's just up to the consumer to decide whether they can afford it without any sort of external help.
Yeah, there's no subsidies in China at all at the moment. I think there's a little bit on, you can slightly better in terms of easier to get a number plate, which can be important in some cities. But otherwise, there's nothing really driving this. What you're seeing is that it's just purely price, ease of use, availability. Now, I said your entry level BYD, not only is it cheaper to buy, cheaper to run, but now comes with a karaoke machine, whilst you're stuck with a dodgy radio in the ICE equivalent. It's more exciting, it's better, it's cooler. And obviously in the luxury market, they're much better. I was in India 2 weeks ago, chatting to one of the largest dealers, auto dealers in India, and they've just signed up BYD, and they called it the dark horse. And take these numbers, there's a pinch of salt, but they basically said for equivalent electric vehicle from BMW, BYD was half the build cost. So not half the price, but half the build cost. And they could just take, if they're allowed to launch without government restrictions, they're going to just take vast amounts of market share. So I think in India, and this is a market where no one believed would electrify, we're going to be really surprised how quickly people start buying electric vehicles, because I can start seeing out there, you've now got electricity in all the rural areas that's happened in the last couple of years. Why wouldn't you buy a car which was cheaper, or a two-wheeler which is cheaper?
And so how are you actually investing in this theme? Which stocks do you own that are related to electric vehicles?
So in India, we own a company called KPIT Technologies. It's a purely software company. They do the outsource software to allow electric vehicles to run, operate. I think they are a world leader in the space. And they mostly work for Western, Japanese, US, European OEMs who are incapable of really doing the software in-house because they're manufacturing companies. And that's a business which has been compounding 40-50% for the last 4 or 5 years. And we think that continues for the next 4 or 5 years. The key advantage we have is understanding that the product cycle for electric vehicles is different from that for a standard vehicle. Standard vehicle, 10-year cycle, 5-year refresh. In an electric vehicle, your cycle is about 3 years with a 1.5-year refresh. So much, much faster. Bit like a mobile phone. So that's one name. The one in China that we really like is Li Auto, and it's one of the top 10 in our holdings. When you're investing in OEM in a fast-growing segment, you can buy companies which do all the technology or are really exciting in different ways. Our key view was we want a company which produces a car people want to buy and they can make money. And Li Auto, given its background in a consumer-facing business, Makes cars people want to buy today at the right price with the right features. And it's really important. They basically have one model, no extras. Every single component, every single added feature in that vehicle is priced because people want it rather than an additional extra. So if Chinese consumers are not willing to pay for the LiDAR or the extra screen or whatever it is, it's not in the car. And they've managed to go from, we're talking 2022, 130,000 vehicles sold in China. Last year it was 380,000 vehicles. This year we're seeing numbers forecast of 600 to 800,000 vehicles. Mostly in a sort of upper mass to luxury range in SUVs, and they're just launching what they call the Mega, which is a 7-seater MPV, fully electric, this year in a very sleek design. Where now, and again, it's coming back to your battery charging. I think they can charge in 10 minutes to 80%, and it can drive 600 kilometers. Again, getting rid of that sort of range anxiety that we're seeing. So Li Auto, I think, is going to surprise. It's been surprising the market for the last 3 years. I think this is going to be a global brand, which people go, wow, in the luxury market, people are going to get excited. Also, like BYD, very cheap, global player. It's the global scale leader. Continue to take market share on a global basis.
That was Ewan Marks and Brown from the Crux Asia ex Japan Fund. Sticking with the tech sector now, Tom Sieber and Steve Fraser from Shares Magazine join us to talk about why Apple shares have been left behind by their big tech counterparts so far in 2024, and just how worried investors should be about an antitrust lawsuit against the company in the US.
So if you look at the performance of Apple since the start of the year, it might be in danger of being kicked out of the Magnificent Seven Club. Despite a decent enough first quarter for the broader US tech sector, Apple shares are down around 8% year to date, with the company enduring its latest setback as the US filed a landmark lawsuit against the company, accusing it of monopolizing the smartphone market and restricting competition. So, Steve, let's start there. Just how damaging could this be for Apple?
Well, first off, it's quite amusing to imagine Apple being kicked out of the Magnificent Seven. I mean, if you imagine, this is ultimately a market cap based gang of companies, if you want to call them that, and six of them are still valued at over $1 trillion. Now, go back 2 years or so, and no company had ever been valued at over $1 trillion. Now you've got six of them already. Apple's the second biggest. It's worth $2.6 billion, $1 trillion. It's staggering. It would have to lose, I don't know, about 80% of its value to get kicked out of the Magnificent Seven realistically. In terms of the US lawsuit, I mean, it's like many of these lawsuits, and they come pretty frequently, right? No one really knows how big an impact it may or may not have. And the problem for investors is you probably won't find out for quite a few years to come because litigation drags on and it drags on and it drags on. Now, the big threat, I suppose, at this point is that how much time does that take away from Tim Cook and the rest of his executive team from getting that Apple run, running the Apple business? That's probably one of the bigger concerns. But if you look across what analysts are generally saying, it seems to be pretty much a case of, well, we've seen this before. There's been fines handed out in the EU, there's been fines handed out elsewhere in the world. So ultimately, it sounds pretty much like that's the expectation that down the line, some kind of fairly chunky fine will come Apple's way. And it may or may not demand that Apple has to change its actual business model. But we'll really have to wait and see. But certainly at this stage, I think it wouldn't be sensible to worry too much about it.
No, the headlines sound quite cataclysmic, don't they? But if you look at how the shares reacted on the day, yes, there was a move. It was kind of a material move for a company that size, but it wasn't anything hugely out of the ordinary, was it?
It was 4% on the day, Tom. I mean, we write about and talk about companies all the time that are moving significantly more than 4%. And even for a company of its size, it's still not that dramatic, which really puts into context how the market itself is really valuing this as a threat. It's basically saying it probably won't be that big a deal, but at this stage, we just don't know. So what we're not going to do is start panic selling Apple shares, which has been such a brilliant investment for 2 decades.
Absolutely. It's not been the only kind of issue to beset or kind of negative or contributor to negative sentiment towards Apple so far this year, though, is it? I guess you've had, well, let's take them in turn. You've had the weak sales of iPhones in China. So maybe could you talk around that a little bit and what's been going on there and why perhaps investors are slightly concerned about that at least?
Yeah, I mean, it's their second biggest market, China, and it may well become its biggest market, given the size of the population versus the US. The data that was released was the first 6 weeks of 2024. So let's put it into a context. It's quite a small statistical set, but the sales were down about 24%. Now, what do we read into this? It's really difficult to read much more than at the moment. There's clearly a reluctance for consumers to go buying new handsets. Bear in mind, there's a new handset like to come out towards the end of this year, the iPhone 16. It might be that lots of consumers are sitting on their hands and going to wait for that new handset to come out. You've also had these issues around various Chinese government bodies. Allegedly, and I say allegedly because it's not been confirmed as far as I'm aware, banning the use of iPhones for work purposes and stuff. So there just seems to be a lot of confusion around Apple's iPhones and how Chinese nationals are or are not allowed to use them. So we need some more clarity, really. But again, when you don't know for sure that there's a big negative, the market naturally assumes some sort of negative impact, but we don't know that there is a massive negative impact as it stands. So the 24% sales drop, I mean, you could argue that away as being a cyclical thing. You might argue it, as you say, it's something that Apple ultimately can recover from fairly comfortably through the rest of this year. But you know, we're still early in the year. You know, we're only just getting to the end of the first quarter.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if you start to see more of a trend, or that become a trend rather than just, like you said, one small data set or one small snapshot, it might suggest that you're genuinely seeing domestic smartphone manufacturers perhaps taking significant share from Apple in China, which I guess would be a headwind for the business. There's no
Oh,
getting
of
around.
course. But I mean, you know, Apple has been challenged by competition right from the get-go of the iPhone. So competition is not new. What's really giving some of the Chinese Huawei and some of these other manufacturers a bit of a boost is because they're producing phones that are almost as good as your top-rated Samsung or your top-rated iPhone, and they're significantly cheaper. But you have to value that Apple has got this walled garden ecosystem. So once you're in this walled garden ecosystem, it's connected watches, it's connected health apps, it's connected TV. It's quite difficult for consumers to say, right, I'm going to ditch the whole ecosystem and go elsewhere. So even if there is a genuine shift in view towards our Apple, it's still actually difficult for bums to actually shift. And there's no real evidence that there is a massive mental shift away from Apple. I mean, Apple is as big as it is because it's got so many fans. People just love the products. They think they're absolutely brilliant. So I really think we need to be a bit careful about sending sort of panicky signals into the investor base. There really isn't anything as yet that I can see to suggest anything other than a more cyclical nature to these competitive elements.
A sort of longer term issue, perhaps, or an area where there's some fear that Apple might be being left behind is on artificial intelligence and its strategy there. And it's certainly, I guess, it hasn't come out perhaps with as much as some of you know, its big counterparts, particularly in the US. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, do you remember when the iPhone came out? Tell us a little pop quiz. Do you remember the year the iPhone came out?
I'm going to go 2007, 8. I'm hedging my bet.
Very good guess. 2007 is when the iPhone launched. So great guess, Tom. Since then, they've launched the Apple Watch. And they've recently launched the Vision Pro headset. But pretty much, there's been a real lack of innovation in terms of new products. And I think that's one thing that has really resonated with the investor base, is that since Steve Jobs left the hot seat, the CEO seat, and Tim Cook took over, there does seem to be a lack of innovation. And that's, of course, going to be a worry. You remember that, of course, Apple is still very much a hardware company. The software it produces is very much reliant on selling its devices. And when you just don't have a regular supply of new devices coming through, it becomes a bit more tricky, especially when iPhone sales just generally are starting to drift a little bit.
Yeah.
So what we've seen over the last, I don't know, probably about three to 5 years, is the revenues from iPhones coming down slightly, but the revenues from services, so that's your Apple Music, the App Store, Apple TV, Apple Pay, et cetera, those revenues are growing, and they are higher margin. So that's great for Apple's profitability. The things like iPads and Macs and so on have kind of moved here and there over the last few years, but that kind of middle set of products hasn't really shifted dramatically. Sure. Bigger or particularly smaller. So it's really a case of iPhone revenues are starting to drift and services revenues have picked up the slack. So that's encouraging in terms of its profitability going forward, because services revenue should be much higher margin. But of course, that's where this US lawsuit also comes in about, is there enough competition? Is there enough access to third parties, to its walled garden ecosystem? So I think there is an ongoing question about Apple's innovation. And you think back to earlier this year when it finally put the nail in the coffin to Project Titan, which was its very fanciful electric car, which has been rumored for a good decade, I guess. And no one's ever seen any kind of real evidence that there's ever a car actually anywhere near a production phase. I mean, my feedback from analysts and fund managers is actually one of relief, because realistically, it's a pretty different business model to go from selling $1,000 smartphone to selling a car worth $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $80,000. So I think it's probably quite a sensible move just to move talent away from that area and start moving into hopefully AI solutions. And that's what the rumor has been, that many of the engineers that were working on Project Titan, so ergo it's EV, are now maybe going to find homes in the AI department and the innovation side of Apple. So hopefully that'll be good news longer term for its AI story, which has been a bit damp, to be honest. If you think that companies like Microsoft and Google and Meta have really been leading the way, really, in terms of the software side of AI. And you'd think Apple really should be at the forefront, and they certainly haven't been. So any move towards being a bit more exciting on that front will gather more excitement among investors, clearly.
As we record, we're a few weeks away from Apple posting its second quarter numbers. Is there anything else that is likely to be in focus at that point, or is it likely to be, most of the topics we've just touched on there?
I mean, I think that the big story is going to be about iPhone. So Apple stopped splitting out iPhone numbers in terms of how the volume of handsets sold, and they just tell you about the revenues now. As long as the revenues look pretty stable, I suspect that will send more calming signals towards the investor base. In terms of looking at the earnings available, I mean, no analyst is predicting there to be any kind of major fall off. They seem to be looking for pretty consistent growth. So we're looking at Q2 earnings of $1.51, I think, is the consensus at the moment, according to CoreFin data, followed by a Q3 of 132 and a Q4 of 154. Now, this is in the ballpark of what it did last year. So no one's really expecting there to be massive growth this year. So the question is going to be what's going to move Apple back into sort of the growth of double digits, where at the moment it's been doing sort of more higher single digits. And that's a reasonable question to ask, whether whether you're paying a premium for a high single digit growth company is reasonable or not. Of course, at the same time, Apple are increasing buying shares now, but it's buying back their own shares and paying dividends. So the investment story has certainly changed over the last 5 to 7 years. It's not quite the gung-ho growth company it once was. But it's become a lot more of a stable kind of core holding, I suppose, in many people's portfolios. And in fairness, if you're an active investor, it'd be almost unheard of for you not to own a little bit of Apple via a fund, an ETF or something, because it's just so widely held.
Big thanks to Tom and Steve from Shares Magazine. Before we go, I just want to flag that we've got a bonus episode of the podcast out early next week on the investment trust sector. So this month, we're looking at dividend hero trusts that paid out a growing... Sorry, she's not reliable. We can't use the word reliable, can we? Okay. Big thanks to Tom and Steve from Shares Magazine. Before we go, I just want to flag that we've got a bonus episode of the podcast out early next week on the investment trust sector. We'll be looking at dividend heroes, which are investment trusts that have increased their dividends each year for at least 20 years in a row. We'll also have an interview about investment opportunities in the renewable energy sector.
So don't miss that. And we'll also be back next week with our usual Money and Markets podcast. We'll see you then.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes, and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell or Shares Magazine. The podcast isn't telling you if a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can change, and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that how you're taxed will depend on your individual circumstances, and rules can change. The way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.